The subject of both sides of this recording is post-war liberalism. In this discussion, we deal with post-war liberalism at home in the United States. Our speakers are Warren Sussman of Rutgers University and Lloyd Gardner. Mr. Gardner.
Well, Warren, I suppose we might start discussing post-war liberalism with the question of whether President Harry S. Truman marks a break with Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal, or its continuation fulfillment. I think that historians, at least those I know, have been concerned with this question both in foreign and domestic affairs for several years now, and there doesn't seem to be any sign that this controversy is letting up. I don't know what we can add to it, but maybe we could start that way.
Well, it seems, Lloyd, that the Americans of his own day and those who regarded themselves as liberals divided on that issue. Witness the break in the Democratic Party by 1948 and the movement created by Henry Wallace. But I think it's clear in looking at the record that Mr. Truman's whole sense of his administration led him in the direction of finishing, or attempting to finish, the tasks which had become the traditional tasks of the liberal national state as conceived of by American liberals, by at least one mainstream of American liberals, since the end of the 19th century. And I'm thinking specifically of that whole series of extraordinary measures which, first of all, through the Full Employment Act, committed the United States to Keynesianism and economics, giving it an economic philosophy which had been hinted at variously through the New Deal, but had never been finalized. The establishment of a system to take care of national resources, the whole establishment of the Atomic Energy Commission, the involvement with the and creation of the National Security Council, the development of CIA, the establishment of, in foreign affairs, as you have suggested, the treaty arrangements under NATO and other such arrangements were to follow. It seems to me one could look at all of those as putting a kind of capstone on what had been the liberal dream, or the liberal goal, the creation of the welfare security system that had finally come into being with the Second War and after. And in that sense, liberalism was fulfilled by Truman. But as you know, I've already suggested, there were serious dissenters that we also regard as New Deal liberals, like Mr. Wallace.
Well, Truman, I think, also considered himself much less visionary than Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And if you look at the major proposals that he tried to put through in what he called a fair deal, the Brannan Plan in agriculture, universal military training, some form of national health insurance, how far he would have gone with that, I don't know. But he always regarded these programs as different than New Deal pragmatism, if you like. I mean, he had a much greater passion for order than Roosevelt ever displayed. And I think that may have attracted some conservatives to Truman, who were not particularly attracted to Roosevelt's running around, yet in search of ideal objectives. Yet, at the same time, Truman never had the kind of congressional support for many of his final objectives that Roosevelt did, at least in the early years in the New Deal. So when you talk about the fair deal, you're not talking about a program that ever really finally came into operation, even down to this day. Truman, as you know, laments this greatly in his memoirs and says that he could have, with a different Congress or with a different kind of situation, brought many of these things to final completion. I think you're right, however, in suggesting that such things as the Full Employment Act of 1946, the president, which required the president to make an annual message on the state of the economy, to give some central direction to the economy.
And the whole idea of guaranteeing
full
employment as a government goal.
And the same, well, now you mentioned that, the same drive in labor unions in the post-war period for the guaranteed annual wage. Which was quite different than, say, the drive of labor unions during the New Deal, for what looked to be, at least at times, a political position. Now they're talking about a guaranteed position within the industry.
It seems to me, again, Lloyd, that you've got a sort of funny thing operating here, because, as we've already suggested, there was hostility in the Congress, a hostility led by a conservative, of a conservative coalition, led very largely by our old friend Senator Taft from Ohio. And yet, while Taft, for example, is equated with anti-labor legislation, in terms of the Taft-Hartley law, which the rhetoric of the times insisted that must be repealed if one were a liberal or a Democrat. On the other hand, Taft is also associated with pushing public housing measures. So it's a very strange kind of conservatism, at least in terms of some domestic measures. People argued about the excessive power of big government, and yet on the other hand, you see even conservatives willing to give way. But it does seem to me that where issues become very tricky on this whole question of post-war liberalism, and where post-war liberalism got itself into major difficulties, we're not simply in the field of foreign affairs, although I think that's involved in it, but this whole question of communism and anti-communism, which becomes such a burning kind of passion by the end of the 40s and on into the early 50s. And that, in a sense, changes the whole course of the discussion, the argument, the debate. The whole force of the thrust of the anti-communist crusade. And maybe we ought to talk about this for a while in reference to what it does to the very nature of American liberalism.
Well, you know, the people who were elected to Congress in 1946, whether they were Democrats or Republicans, and two outstanding examples that come to mind immediately are Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, both of whom had war records in the Navy, both of whom professed to be replacing men who were worn out in positions of traditional liberalism. And although there was a great deal of controversy, say, about the tactics that Richard Nixon used in the campaign against Jerry Voorhees out in California, the major thrust of the Nixon campaign was that Jerry Voorhees was the candidate of a labor movement aspiring to political power, and that this was in tune with certain objectives, sub rosa perhaps, of the international communist movement. Now, John Kennedy's election in Massachusetts was carried out in a spirit of a sort of action-oriented realism, not certainly liberal ideology in Massachusetts. And Kennedy became a member, almost a member at least, of the China lobby in Congress, blasting the Truman administration, his own party's administration, for the loss of China, supposedly, and taking both Nixon and Kennedy, this type of man in Congress, certainly did exactly what you're suggesting. That is, they made the anti-communist issue equal to or more important than many of the other questions which had come up in the New Deal. Although they look back, all of them look back on the New Deal period as a watershed in American history, did not set about, certainly, to reverse any of the reforms that were carried out.
Of course, it is indicative that the New Deal lived its most extraordinary days during the Popular Front movement, where an alliance implicitly on the part of at least the communists existed. There wasn't a hostility on the part of the left to the New Deal. And the whole mood has now changed significantly. The labor unions are specifically rooting out communists. The ADA, the Americans for Democratic Action, which is supposedly a liberal movement, is dedicated and devoted to its anti-communist position. We are about to have the unleashing of McCarthy and McCarthyism, which carries over into the administration of Eisenhower.
Well, it's interesting in this light that the ADA would have accepted Eisenhower as a presidential
candidate.
Because it obviously was sort of in the position, I think, of trying to assert its patriotism and a liberal patriotism as being more viable than a soft conservatism, if you like, or an isolationist conservatism. This is what they always posed themselves as standing against. And activist Pragmatic, realistic is a big liberal word in this period. Realism and realistic.
See, one of the things that I think is so interesting about this period from the point of view of liberalism is having achieved so many objectives, even having moved on somewhat in terms of the President's Commission on Civil Rights and on certain other issues, even though the limits that you've suggested existed, there soon developed a kind of dissatisfaction with the nature and quality of American life in the 50s, under those great Eisenhower years, those peaceful Eisenhower years, dissatisfaction that shows up in a whole set of investigations about American life. Everything from McCarthyism to the Kinsey Report. All sorts of things are discovered about American life that is not desirable. Scandal in government, gangsters in government, communists in churches, all of this sort of, those Eisenhower years sort of indicate a kind of reassessment of liberalism and where liberals ought to stand and what liberals are. And really, were those Eisenhower years, in spite of the fact you have a Republican president, were they different? Were there different people in office? Were there different people administering things? Were there basic ideological splits? It seemed very hard to find any. And yet there was a kind of growing sense of dissatisfaction with what liberalism had achieved, whether welfare really was the answer, whether the welfare state, this enormous welfare state with the increases of Social Security every year or thereabouts and movements in the direction of health insurance and education, government aid to education, all of these things, people began to doubt the value of these things.
Well, you know, that people look back now, at least certain liberals look back now and see Adlai Stevenson as the great light or the great alternative in the 1950s. You have to... A very famous comedian from that era, in talking about the two Eisenhower-Stevenson campaigns, said, my God, who's going to save us from these extremes between Stevenson's moderate liberalism and Eisenhower's liberal moderatism, if you like? And I think there is that, certainly. And one did not see at the time so much of the broad, or what is supposed to be the broad ideological differences between a Stevenson and between an Eisenhower. Another reflection of this was brought to my attention by a psychiatrist friend who suggested that in the pre-war period, when psychiatrists treated disturbed people, they took very much the stand that these people should try to find themselves. But in the post-war period, psychiatrists were trying to get people to adjust themselves to the society. And there may be something broader than just simply the treatment of mentally disturbed people.
Well, you know, this is the kind of issue that's really raised in books like The Organization Man, and The Cane
Mutiny. Man in the Gray Flannel Suit.
And The Cane Mutiny, all of those things that were so popular in the 1950s. And, you know, as I think the other side of this that is increasingly clear if one examines the record, as you move on to the Kennedy years and to the Johnson years, the president increasingly finds it very difficult to operate effectively in the domestic realm. He discovers an enormous bureaucracy that does not yield easily. It's a bureaucracy in one sense, one can argue, that the liberals have created, but they can't, even a man with the genius of Lyndon Johnson for manipulating within the Congress, finds it very difficult to put through his very dramatic domestic program. And both Kennedy and Johnson almost immediately find themselves involved in major international struggles, which they turn their attention to. And maybe one of the reasons they do turn their attention to them is that it is in the international field that these people, these presidents, find it much easier to operate, rather than through the intricacies of enormous congressional politics and red tape. And the other thing that I think is true on that side as well is that Congress increasingly becomes important as an investigatory body, more and more investigations, and less really ability to think through serious legislative problems. That is, after you pass through those crucial days of the late 1940s with the great bulk of the Truman legislation, it seems to me less and less, now, of course, obviously, there are certain major points in terms of civil rights legislation and other pieces of legislation. I don't mean to downplay all of those. But less and less even that Congress can do, and more it turns its attention to investigate. And the more it investigates, the more it discovers it is wrong. And meanwhile, the president more and more involves himself with networks of treaty alliances and arrangements that involve the whole situation in Cuba, etc. A whole series of things.
Yes, well, I think the what you're talking about in terms of the atomic age has profound implications for congressional policies and domestic legislation, too. Everything seems speeded up.
Mm-hmm.
Congressmen find themselves really at a loss to combat the bureaucratic experts that testify before them. It's easy, as in the case of the House Un-American Affairs Activities Committee, which investigates communists in Hollywood or in the entertainment
right.
industry at large. It's easy to ferret out individuals who apparently have been guilty in their eyes of some flagrant violation.
Or Kefauver with drugs.
Or Kefauver with drugs, investigations of
organized crime,
John McClellan, and so mm-hmm. on. But it's much more difficult for a congressman to be as up on any issue, domestic or foreign,
right.
as a bureaucrat who testifies before him. And in this situation, you find Congress retreating increasingly into a background position. You remember James McGregor Burns in discussing whether or not presidents could come from Congress or not, talked about the Congressional Party and its opposite, the Governor's Party or Leader's Party. And he found it more and more difficult for Congress to produce, ironically, the kind of leader who could become a good president. Yet, in the end, we have Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, all coming out
right.
of that rather than
out of the governor's
out of the governing.
Well, I think the point
themselves.
That you make is absolutely crucial, really, in terms of the whole question of what constituted the basic premises of liberalism. Because people no longer could serve as their own experts. When you begin to deal with atomic energy and pollution and military strategy and how much deterrent you need to do this, that, and the other thing, and the building of a defense establishment, which is such an important part of this whole era, and you begin to deal with all of these questions that call for atomic energy, which call for profound expertise. And you reach a situation where the budget is so enormous, and even parts of the budget are kept secret from the Congress because they deal with matters of international diplomacy and security. Even Congress don't even the Congress itself does not even know what it is voting for in some of these measures, nor can it in terms of the complexities involved in understanding this enormous budget. And yet, the whole theory of liberalism, it seems to me, at least in the pre-war period, came from those basic old Jeffersonian premises that if you knew the facts, you could figure out what ought to be done. Well, the point is that our representatives could no longer even figure out what ought to be done, let alone the people who sent the representatives to Congress. That is, some of the basic tenets behind the whole tradition of liberalism seem to be falling away.
Yeah, well, this impasse you're talking about really begins not even in the, if we can go back for a second, not even in the Truman period, but probably in 1938, when Roosevelt finds it impossible to purge certain,
mm-hmm.
What he considers reactionary elements from the Congress. Now, when you get into the 1940s and 1950s, these reactionary elements are double block. They are, one, as you say, not their own experts. They can't be. Many of them are country lawyers. Who sit on committees, congressional committees, and gather seniority and finally arise to the chairmanship, and who really have no ideas.
Mm-hmm.
They simply want to survive politically. And these people increasingly form a very powerful block against any man who wants to move the country on domestic legislation in directions that these, as sociologists call them, veto groups
mm-hmm.
or veto blocks do not want to move. And the civil rights issue is a good example. Truman in 1948 had to withstand a challenge from the left, the Wallace people, and a challenge from a right, the Southern Bloc, or the Strom Thurmond Independent third party group, fourth party group in that campaign. Yet he won
mm-hmm.
And put together a coalition by staying right on what he thought was the middle of the issues while giving both sides hell.
Mm-hmm.
That was Clark Clifford's famous strategy. It's a strategy for winning elections, but it's not really a strategy for getting an awful lot of legislation through Congress.
The other thing that's interesting, again, in talking about this in terms of the various branches of government, is to look at the reversal in attitudes or the complex changes in attitudes in reference to the court. All through the 30s, the court that had been opposing in its majorities what the New Deal Congress's wish to do was being attacked, those nine old men and the court packing business, and the court was sort of the enemy. By 1954, with Brown versus Topeka, the court becomes the champion of liberals. The liberals begin to look increasingly to the Warren Court for a whole series of decisions, which they get, which are, of course, now about to appear to be challenged by a more conservative court under Mr. Nixon. But in the 50s and in the 60s, it was the court that became a kind of liberalizing branch of government.
And you know, the Warren Court is the Eisenhower Court. It's not
the
Truman Court.
That's right. It's very much the Eisenhower Court.
And most of the appointments that
Truman
are made
administrations
there,
were dreadful.
And if you
from the liberals' point of view.
And if you look at the Kennedy appointments, too.
That's right.
In the last days of the Warren Court, these were often the conservative dissenters. Not the Johnson appointees, but the Kennedy appointees were certainly in that position. Raising that question, does that make Johnson more of a traditional New Deal liberal, say, than Truman and Kennedy, the other two Democratic presidents in this period? I wonder, since he was so concerned with domestic legislation, much more so, I suppose, certainly than Kennedy.
I think it's well worth thinking about Johnson, as many people have done. The idea is not new. Many people have done. But well, we're thinking of Johnson in terms of a kind of populist heritage, populist tradition, in terms of the kind of programs he argued for. But the interesting thing is that it is, in a sense, almost too late and too far away from that whole era and the set of problems that it represented. The cities lay in decay. No one knew quite how to handle the problem. The welfare situation was clearly unsatisfactory, and the rather utopian notions that the Johnsonians had for putting more power into the hands of those who were poverty-stricken themselves and letting them direct some of the programs did not seem to operate effectively. The whole populist vision that he tried to install into some of those programs seemed to me did not meet the circumstances of the time. Whatever the value of the ideological premises behind them, they didn't seem essentially to work. So you've got a question of really the need to rethink the whole problem. Because suddenly, once again, one begins to discover in those Kennedy-Johnson years the problem of poverty in ways in which it has to be faced anew. One had thought almost that they had been solved by the New Deal and New Deal liberalism, and it's perfectly clear they had not been. There was no effective income redistribution, as book after book showed. What's more, the problems that were inherent in that were not simply the humanitarian ones related to the poor, but the whole question of the relationship between income maldistribution and possibility of depression, the constant fear of recession, depression, balance of payments, confusions, etc., the state of the economy, could the question of economic growth, which Mr. Kennedy played at so in the election of 1960, and which has become such a major issue since, and the question of gross national profit. There's always this haunting fear of the whole system being unable to function economically, and part of it has to do with this question of economic distribution of income.
Well, you're suggesting here, I think, another point that's interested me, and that is that Mr. Nixon in 1968 could therefore run on a platform not only in opposition to the Vietnam War, but in opposition to simply trying more of the Johnson New Deal populist solutions. An underlying theme of that campaign, of course, Vietnam was the major issue, but an underlying theme of that campaign was that even liberalism had to divorce itself from traditional solutions to these problems. And this made it possible for some liberals, most outstandingly, I suppose, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, to associate himself on a very high level with the Nixon administration, because he argued, in effect, that it was time to take a look at the ways in which civil rights had been handled, and it was time to approach the problem of racism from a different point of view. Similarly, you have Nixon now opting for programs which, toward the end of the Johnson administration, liberals were beginning to talk about, such as revenue sharing between the federal government and the states, and a whole other panorama of issues which many liberal Democrats have begun to think about, and which Nixon managed to take over for his own. In fact, his administration, rather than a repudiation of liberalism, in some ways reminds one of this kind of rethinking of liberalism.
And, of course, the final irony is that Mr. Nixon's willingness to adopt, when necessary in terms of mounting inflation, wage and price controls, which had been an anathema, theoretically, to Republicans and conservatives as a way of dealing with economic problems. What Mr. Nixon did, in effect, was to leave the Democrats almost no issue, except maybe the war issue, and even there we can talk about how he neutralized them on that. And in many ways, I think, as you've suggested, Nixon remains a kind of representative, in quotes, American liberal of the post-war stripe. Seems to me that the tradition from Roosevelt on, as Mr. Nixon tried to make clear in his current campaign, is one that he can join with those presidents who went before him, Democrats and Republicans, and claim himself to be in the American mainstream.
Nixon's two heroes, as both he himself says and his biographers have suggested, are Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson.
Yes.
And he regards these men as activist types of presidents that he wants to emulate. He is trying very hard, whether he will succeed or not, he is trying very hard, I think, to modernize liberalism and strike out on a new path for liberalism.
Lloyd Gardner, Warren Sussman, thank you. The subject of this discussion is post-war American liberalism and foreign affairs. Our speakers are Warren Sussman of Rutgers University and Lloyd Gardner. Warren Sussman.
Lloyd, looking at the development, most especially of liberalism in reference to the world, and that means in reference to America, largely in terms of this discussion, to American foreign policy in the post-war years. As you know, there's a considerable debate about whether, in fact, the whole Cold War would have happened, whether American foreign policy would have taken on the particular outlines it did take on in the post-war world if Mr. Roosevelt hadn't died and Mr. Truman hadn't taken over. Is there a real break? Is there something distinctive about American foreign policy since the Second War? In reference to this whole theme of the liberal America, or is it more of the same?
Well, you know, if we go back to the early years of the Cold War, the interpretation that the Cold War would not have happened had Roosevelt lived, in effect, really started a political movement. That is, Henry Wallace, the man whom many liberals thought was cheated out of the presidency by Truman, campaigned from 1946 on, and when he began it with his Madison Square Garden speech attacking the Get Tough policy, through 1948. And then that, when he ran for president, and then that interpretation faded out as the Cold War became intense. And then in the 1960s, a group of liberal revisionist historians re-put the question, insisting that had Roosevelt lived, there would have been no Cold War or something very much less than the Cold War. Now, I think it's perfectly true that Harry Truman was put in a position where he had to make decisions with less information than Roosevelt had. He'd not been kept informed by Roosevelt. He once said that as far as he knew, the China policy was going along quite successfully, and he discovered when he became president that China was, in fact, about to go into a major civil war, which would lead to a communist takeover in China. All of these things are certainly true. And at the same time, there are many people who, because Truman lacked the prestige that Roosevelt supposedly had in international affairs, urged him to make decisions all the more quickly because there would be a terrible gap between Roosevelt's death and Truman's full assurance as a president and as a world leader. Now, even with all of these considerations, however, I think that the basic issues which developed in the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States would have remained. But even more than that, I think that the issues do not simply come down to the Soviet Union and the United States. The Cold War is something much larger than these two countries, and these two powers play a role in the Cold War. But the Cold War also encompasses the entire anti-colonial revolution, the entire question of how European society would be restructured after the war, thus the election of a British Labour government in July of 1945 was in some ways as disturbing to American foreign policymakers as the occupation of the Eastern Europe by the Red Army. So we have to consider all these things together.
How much of the whole rhetoric of the Cold War is in any sense acceptable? By that I mean, how much of the conflict do you really think can be thought of as ideological? Let me give you a specific question, maybe even to make it more definite. Mr. Wallace's split, Henry Wallace's split, the third party split in 48, is this simply ideology or is this a question of possible strategy? After all, he stayed on for a while in the administration of Mr. Truman. Is there fundamentally an ideological split? Is it a left-right split within the country? Is it an ideological split within the world?
Well, in the Wallace movement, certainly many of Wallace's adherents were ideologically motivated. Now, that's a different thing from saying that the movement itself was ideologically dominated. I think that in this case, most people who were in the Truman side of the argument between Truman and Wallace simply regarded Wallace as naive. That is, if you go back to Wallace's speech in 1946, in which he really launched his opposition to the Truman administration, he argued that on the one hand, we could not push the Soviets around in Eastern Europe any more than we would allow them to push us around in Latin America, which was an interesting acceptance, really, of a spheres of influence, not a revolutionary position, but a spheres of influence policy. But he also argued that the Russians could not deny us economic access to Eastern Europe. Now, in effect, what Wallace's critics then said he was guilty of was an inability to realize that political and economic questions were so completely intertwined in the Cold War period in international affairs, as they had been before, that to talk about, on the one hand, preserving or allowing Russia to have a sphere of influence in Eastern Europe, and at the same time demanding an open world for American expansion, were simply incompatible ideas.
I can remember, even in some of the old Wallace speeches, his warning that we were going to be threatened, if we carried on our current policy, with the loss of that great, rich, potential dream of a China market. Americans have always wanted that China market.
Well, Wallace himself said before a congressional committee that his father had imbued him with the idea of the great China market as a child. It was a dream that Franklin Roosevelt shared. In fact, I suppose...
It's also a dream that Mr. Nixon shared.
Yeah, very much so. And to a degree, Harry Truman was more of a realist about the possibilities of the great China market developing, at least in the immediate period. But, you know, since we have got on to China, I think if you want to talk about phases or epochs in the Cold War, the first phase, in effect, ended with NATO, the establishment of a stable military alliance in Western Europe. And even Arthur Vandenberg, the famous bipartisan senator in the 1940s, said in 1949, well, we seem to have won the Cold War and those Ruskies are going to have to start doing business on our terms. And then in a series of reversals in 1949, first came the announcement that the Russians had exploded an atomic bomb, which had not been expected for some reason, although other people told them this was coming much sooner, which had not been expected for some time. And then in the fall of 1949, We lost China, this marvelous phrase, you know, China. We had China at one time, but we lost it somewhere along the way in the Cold War. So we lost China finally at the end of 1949. And the Republicans, who had been without a foreign policy issue, since, as we said before about liberalism and the problem there, Republicans who had been without a foreign policy issue turned this around in 1950. You know, there are accounts of this famous meeting of Senator Joseph McCarthy with two or three advisors in Georgetown at dinner one evening, and they're looking for an issue, and they decide the communists in government will be the issue. And what it came down to so many times was China, the loss of China. And even when McCarthy went over to attack General Marshall, and that was as far as he dare go, the basic issue there was not Europe at all, but China, Marshall's performance in, on China.
Well, what is basic to an understanding of what Cannon was to write in his famous memorandum, to the whole notion of containment, in terms of an ideological position or what it means as a statement of American foreign policy position? What I'm asking is this: is there a positive counterpart to containment? I mean, containment is a very negative vision of what is involved here. I mean, ultimately you're going to get with Mr. Dulles at least talk about something that goes beyond containment, brinkmanship, and even the possible of rollback, etc. How serious are we to take all of that? Is there a positive thrust, or are we really worried about simply maintaining a kind of status quo in the world against revolution in general and against communist revolutions specifically?
Yes, we're obviously a positive thrust in trying to prevent communist revolutions. I think that containment, and you have to remember that Kennan was a European-trained, European-oriented diplomat. Containment, in his mind, referred to a specific set of problems which existed between 1945 and 1949. Now, the problem with containment is twofold. On the one hand, Mr. Kennan claims that people misunderstood him. He did not mean a military policy. He was talking about a political threat. But on the other hand, in Kennan's own language, in his own words, there's no way really to separate a military policy from a political policy. He was much disturbed when Harry Truman launched the Truman Doctrine for military aid to Greece and Turkey, saying these were unreliable allies and so on in private. And also that we really did not have any critical geographical interest in Greece and Turkey. And if you take a map of the world and the closeness of Greece and Turkey to oil reserves, to keeping the Mediterranean open, then you find the United States really is in Great Britain's place. You can't have containment, say, in France and Italy without also having containment in Greece and Turkey. And if you can't stop there, where can you stop? This is the problem with this. Now, what Dulles did in 1953 was to analyze containment, in 1952 really, and analyze containment as an ideological question, aside from these strategic questions, and say, well, containment puts you in a negative role in much the same way that the dynamic powers of the 1930s, Great Britain and static powers in the 1930s, Great Britain and France tried to contain the dynamic powers, Italy, Germany, and even Japan. Therefore, you have to have a dynamic foreign policy, and he called this foreign policy liberation. And what he meant was that he was going to be liberating not so much the East Europeans, but Americans from the negative stance of the containment rhetoric and policy.
One of the things about this that I find fascinating, because the rhetoric itself is fascinating with its notion of deterrence and containment, etc., is that the other thing that comes into vogue is these people begin to talk about themselves as realists, as over against moralists. And yet it seems to me that there's an enormous moral undertone here that has been traditional in American liberalism about the virtues of the American nation, especially as conceived of as a particular kind of white Christian Anglo-Saxon society that one sees running all through Kennan and Dulles and even Acheson. Maybe
reaching its height in the Kennedy.
And the Kennedy, right. Seems to be a very strong moral impetus, which the United States sees itself in terms of a particular vision, keeping a particular vision of the world operative. When you begin to look at the enormous arrangement of treaties, not only NATO, but CETO and all of the rest, it seems to me that the whole vision of what the United States must be in terms of keeping the world operative and keeping its institutions in some sense dominant or controlling or at least keeping things calm, especially as the rest of the world, and as you've said, I think very importantly said, well, the rest of the world, meaning a colonial world that's an upheaval against pre-World War II colonialism in Africa, in Asia, everywhere you look, the world in South America, the world is churning in a kind of revolutionary outpouring, the likes of which we hadn't seen since the late 19th, early 20th century, and yet the whole vision of the United States seems to me, if I'm right, a kind of moral vision that the so-called realists keep about the place that the United States must maintain. And it seems to me this is part and parcel of what American liberalism has always been, this kind of moral vision. It worked in the 19th century in terms of the whole missionary movement, etc.
Well, you know, realism itself is a word which has changed, and I think this is very important to our discussion. The first realists, and Kennan considered himself a realist, Hans Morgenthau, the whole Chicago school of foreign policy, the first realists really meant that they wanted to keep moral considerations out of foreign policy. That is, we couldn't be Wilsonian in the sense of worrying so much about whether or not each people had independence and whether or not we were striking a moral pose, all right? Now, realism in the late 1960s after Vietnam and 1970 really means that we have too many commitments overseas and we have to limit our scope of operations. Now, if we understand this, I think we begin to understand the question that you're getting at, because it then becomes incumbent upon each administration to be tougher than the last in excluding what we used to call moral considerations from foreign policy, if possible. Although, as you rightly say, there's a complete paradox here, or contradiction, because they are assuming that American institutions are better than any other institutions and can be imposed. The height of this, of course, is reached in the Kennedy administration,
right,
when, again, ironically, many of the things that we associate with the 40s and 50s of the Cold War are past. We now have a Sino-Russian split and so on. But at any rate, every man in that Kennedy administration wanted to out-tough every other man. Yeah. Even Pierre Salinger, poor Pierre Salinger, who, you know, in the first days of the Kennedy administration had to take a 50-mile hike to prove his physical fitness. To be a part, to serve on the new frontier, you know.
Yeah.
You had to prove that you were tough-minded and tough in body. A sound mind and a sound body go together in foreign policy considerations. Now, the liberals in foreign policy, if we can use that term again, had in part built themselves into this problem because they were always laying themselves open to attack, they thought, for being too soft on communism.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they had to be stronger than everybody else. Now, coming into power with this kind of appreciation, as they would consider it, for the realities of the world, all of a sudden, things start turning disastrous, beginning with the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
Now, the Bay of Pigs meant a double measure of new toughness had to be added. First, at home, to show that you weren't going to allow the communists to stay in Cuba. And you know, in Kennedy's speech, in which he accepted responsibility for the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy went on later in that speech to say that if something wasn't done about Cuba by the Organization of American States, that the United States would do it. He didn't specify what. But then also, he had expected to go to meet the Soviet Premier Khrushchev in Vienna in a kind of real showplace meeting in which he would demonstrate to Khrushchev the new, sinewy, young, new frontier look, and instead, he found himself going to Vienna as he thought he appeared to Khrushchev as indecisive, weak, unable to control his own advisors.
Business right.
So then he had to take a tougher stand with Khrushchev there, all of which, you know, is a kind of culmination of the things we've been talking about.
Well, one of the things that I find interesting in terms of the way I view the situation, and I stand open for correction is that it seems to me all of these people who, in line with what American liberalism has always been, regard themselves as not ideologues or ideologists, but practical or even pragmatic men, are in fact operating very frequently as ideologues or as moralists. And I find it interesting, for example, when I look back at this period, the one person who seems to me a realist and a pragmatist is not the Secretary of State, Mr. Dulles, but President Eisenhower, who seems to me to be much more practical and pragmatic and less ideological than his Secretary of State, who seems to me to be so overburdened with a whole ideological and moralistic makeup that he doesn't see the kind of simple practical realities that his own chief sees. Is that far-fetched?
No, I don't think so at all, because in part, of course, Eisenhower was the only military president we have in this period, and Eisenhower knew very well that many of the solutions that were proposed for complex political problems, for example, an airstrike at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, would not, in fact, have solved anything at all, and would have led to the kind of complications which finally occur in the 1960s. Now, the Eisenhower approach to foreign policy, at least in 1953, was that there must be at some point a common ground between the opposing forces, the Soviet Union and the United States. The trip he took to Latin America, and that trip, and also Nixon's famous trip to Latin America in the late 1950s when he was stoned by rioting...
I'm glad you added that.
By rioting...
Here's our president.
Students, yes, indeed. meant a reawakening for Eisenhower in that he suddenly discovered that America was not loved as he thought America was loved around the world. I think, you know, that in this regard, as you pointed out, he was very much more flexible than the ideologues of the Cold War.
It seems to me now, again, you know, this is a very difficult ground, but it seems to me it's this kind of ideology or ideological blinders that made us unaware of the situation as it really existed in the world. We didn't read it right. And I think nothing is more dramatic of our failure to see what is really going on in the world than our involvement in Vietnam. In spite of the caution that all sorts of people gave, including General MacArthur, the kind of caution he extended to President Kennedy about any kind of involvement, as Bobby Kennedy tells us in the memoirs, it seems to me that one could almost argue that liberalism, American liberalism, in control of the Department of State, in control of foreign affairs, had really put on a kind of ideological dark glasses and began to see the world as it wished to see it, not as it really was, in spite of the fact these people preach realism all the time, because it seems to me that there are a series of enormous miscalculations involved with the whole involvement in Vietnam and the escalation of that situation. And I don't think Vietnam can be explained in terms of simple economic rationale or other such simple explanations, although goodness knows after you're there for a while there is a kind of economic commitment built in. And I don't mean that it is unrelated to economic situations in Asia, competition with the Japanese, etc., but it seems to me we read that situation in terms of the way we wanted to see the world shaped. And we wanted to see certain governments shaped in the world, and we interfered directly for reasons which seem to me very often to have been largely ideological, if I can use that word.
Well, you know, if we take this as a continuation of the a problem of finding some answer to revolutionary nationalism, it becomes clear, too. That is, Vietnam is not an accidental war at all.
Right.
We didn't get stumbled in there.
No, I agree with that.
We didn't turn the corner and suddenly...
I agree with that.
We were.
It was calculated.
All right, if you take Dulles' reaction to containment, now we have to develop something which he called liberation, which would put us in alliance with the forces of revolutionary nationalism. This, by the end of the Dulles period, had obviously not worked either. And when the Kennedy people come in, they quite clearly direct their efforts toward meeting this revolutionary nationalist challenge, and Vietnam becomes the scene for the decision to meet that. We have a whole bunch of people going out to Vietnam, and after very superficial examinations of the situation, coming back to the United States and saying, we can do this, we can turn this around. So for the whole first couple of years of the Kennedy administration, everything is counterinsurgency. American experts on guerrilla warfare are instructed to read and to train others in the great writings of guerrilla warfare down from ancient times through Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, and of course General Giap, the architect of the French defeat in North Vietnam. We can meet them on this level and at the same time impose from above the needed social reforms in this country, which will make it possible for this country to become, in effect, a kind of showplace in Asia. Now, the effort to do this obviously goes awry. And the more it goes awry, the more people say, well, one more effort and we'll be out. You remember Secretary McNamara continually saying he can see the light at the end of the tunnel, or there won't be any American troops in Vietnam
Christmas, yeah. They're going to bring them on,
but sometimes Tet. But always this kind of assumption that with a little more effort, this will yield to American know-how. The assumption that everything must in the end yield to American know-how. Now Johnson, who becomes president in 1963 upon Kennedy's assassination, had a decision to make on Vietnam within 48 hours of Kennedy's death. And a person who was present at the discussions that Johnson had with his advisors at that time said, I am not going to be the man who lost Indochina the way the Democrats lost China. And now that, I think, is a good example of history at work. A man who sees very clearly that if he, as he puts it, were to lose Indochina, he might also lose support in the nation, both for foreign and domestic policies, plunges ahead, despite warnings from some of his oldest colleagues, like Senator Fulbright, against the unwisdom of continuing this thing, and pursues it, of course, to its final culmination, which in 1968, the Tet Offensive, whether it was a big victory for the Viet Cong or not, drove Lyndon Johnson out of the White House and back down to Texas.
I think part of the irony of all of this is revealed, and part of the failure of liberalism in foreign policy is revealed by what's happened since in the Nixon administration. It seems almost as if 25 years of history have been suddenly reversed. We find ourselves in a situation where we appear willing to achieve a settlement in Vietnam, which leaves us pretty much, in my opinion, where we started. We have now had a spectacular renewal of relationships with China, which was supposedly such an abomination on the face of the earth that we couldn't deal with them. We have made, the president has made a dramatic trip to the Soviet Union, which was absolutely unanticipated 25 years ago. So that one begins to think that the whole last 25 years of American foreign policy and American liberal assumptions about America's place in the world have been a dream, an awful dream, almost a nightmare, because of what it has ultimately cost us in the experience of Vietnam.
You know, the interesting thing to me about this is that Nixon's policy, his big turnabout, if you like, is exactly what Henry Wallace asked for in 1948. Right down to the acceptance of spheres of influence for each of the major powers and the very determined effort to open up all kinds of economic avenues into China and Russia. And the liberals who now criticize Mr. Nixon's foreign policy, I think, must find themselves in something of a quandary, because this is the way Henry Wallace had told them they could avoid the Cold War back in 1948.
I would argue that the difficulties in making the welfare state work effectively and the difficulties in justifying the stance we have taken previously in foreign affairs indicate that there's a serious need to rethink the whole problem of the nature of American liberalism and whether it in fact meets the conditions of the time as we face the second half of the 20th century.
Warren Sussman, Lloyd Gardner, thank you.